my name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. And it is truly an honor to be here. I have so much love and respect for Kathy. When I first met her, and Renee had said, Kathy wants to talk to you, I was scared. Because Kathy sat in the meeting, and you knew she was there. She never talked. She wore an orange hoodie. She had these combat boots on and never talked. And I've watched her go from a woman who sat in a driveway literally her whole life and drank. She would go to work, come home, sit in her driveway and drink. Until it's time to go to bed, she would go inside and go to bed. On the weekends, she would sit in her driveway and drink, and that's all she did. Her mom would go out. She phone would ring. She'd go out into the driveway, and Kathy would be in there drinking, right? It's all, today, I can't get her to shut up. She has a great life, an amazing circle of people, women that she sponsors, and she just bought a house, and she has her own driveway that she doesn't sit in. And I think of the miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you would have told me 4 years ago when her and I had started going through the steps that when Renee and I had a baby, we would ask Kathy to be the godmother of our child, I would have said, you are completely crazy. And today she's the godmother of my son. How does that happen? Well, it's because you work 12 steps out of Alcoholics Anonymous out of this book. That's how this happens. I will say in the last 7 days, I've been to 6 meetings. I'm very active in the steps. I just finished my last amends from the inventory that I wrote last year, and hopefully I'll get time to talk about that. Yesterday, I asked God to remove selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear 16 times, and how I know that's because I keep track, because that's what I was taught to do. This is my nightly review of last night from yesterday. Service, I am the treasurer of the Little Elm Group. I chair the Saturday morning meeting at the Frisco Group. I'm actively taking 15 people through the steps. And I'm telling you that not because I'm a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell you that because this is a spiritual program of action. And anybody in a 5-minute clip in a meeting of AA can sound wonderful. You got to be careful. I meet with my sponsor every month. I'm actively sponsored. I believe that if you are sponsoring people, you should have a sponsor. I'm meeting with Myers this week, and we're going to review my 11-step nightly reviews. I've got some things going on in my life, some great, some not so great, and he doesn't tell me what to do. He asks me a series of questions to help me to find my truth, and that's why I love that man. It's interesting. I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous for what I have today. I'll start with a couple stories. As you guys know, I like stories. It's like old home week for me. I mean, I've missed you guys over the last few months. So the first story I'll tell, so I'm going camping with a dozen friends of mine. We're camped night next to this river, and it's kind of narrow at this spot, and it's moving pretty quick. And we're standing there, and we're having fun doing what we do, and all of a sudden we hear a baby crying. We're like, oh my God, there's a crying baby, and you see this baby floating in the water, and everybody's freaking out until a guy jumps in, we're swimming to go grab him, and we save him, we bring him back, and then all of a sudden you hear another baby crying. And so more guys jump in the water, and there's another baby crying. And all of a sudden we're all trying to get all these babies that are in this river, and we're freaking out, going, oh my God. I'm like, what the hell? And I get out of the water after saving a baby, and I start going upstream, and one of the guys, they're all saying, where are you going, Chris? What are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm going to go find out who the hell's throwing babies upriver. Right? Moral of that lesson is, at some point, you got to quit putting out the fires that are in front of you and find out what the problem is and stop it. That's what this stuff did. I'm not here for relief. I'm here to get freedom. The next story I'll tell is, so there's this priest, and he's new, and he's out in the garden, and he finds this emperor moth cocoon. And they're very ornate and very interesting. The guy grabs it. And he takes it into his room, and he's going to nurture it, and he's going to make sure that the moth comes out, and it's able to fly away, and it's going to be great. And so one day he's watching it, and he sees it starts to move. And all of a sudden he sees the moth breaks free, and it's struggling for life to get free of this cocoon that it's in. And he gets halfway out, and it's stuck. And the priest is like all freaked out and worried. He's like, oh my God, it's stuck. It can't get out. And he watches, and it's still stuck. And he's like, oh my God. And so finally he goes, I'm going to help it get free. So he grabs a little pair of scissors, and he snips it real carefully. And the moth falls out of the cocoon. And then he keeps watching it, and now the moth is struggling because he's waiting for its wings to develop, and the wings aren't developing. And he watches this fat little almost moth, and it never matures all the way. And he takes it to the Monsignor, and he goes, I found this emperor moth cocoon, and it was struggling to get out, so what I did is I cut it free to get it free. And the Monsignor said, you shouldn't have done that. The process for that moth to get out of that cocoon, it's got to struggle, so all the fluid as it moves out of that little tiny hole, it pushes the fluid into its wings, and that's what gets it free. It's the struggle that gives it freedom. What you did is you just killed it by cutting it free too soon. Oh, bummer. And the moral of that story is not, I'm not here to get you relief. I'm not here to relieve your struggles. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're in pain and your life sucks and you don't know what to, good. I hope you don't let anybody take that away from you. Because there'll be people who would love to relieve your pain, help you get a job, help you take care of your legal troubles, talk to your wife about how great you are and you'll get back in the big bed. And when it comes time for you to do inventory, every single motivation for you to do the required action in this program is now gone. Because I've removed your pain. Don't let anybody. I love my sponsor and the people I'm surrounded by because they will gladly rub salt in my wounds. Right? And Kathy's real good at that with me. I believe that there's a huge difference between relief and freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's one thing in the foreword to the second edition. It's actually the last paragraph at the end of it. It says, yet it is our great hope that all those who have yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book. This book. Not the 12 and 12. Not that guide that other dudes have written. This book. And will presently join us on a high road to a new freedom. They're not talking about relief. Being raised that I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked up those words. And the definition of relief is alleviation through removal of pain. Huh. But isn't that why I'm in AA? That sounds good, right? Relieve my pain. But then I looked up freedom and it says exemption from external control. Huh. But isn't that, I don't want to have temporary alleviation of my pain. I grew up in a family where you're not supposed to be alcoholic. My dad was a chief of staff of cardiology. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I got three brothers. I don't know. I'm not supposed to feel this way. I'm supposed to be okay. But I know from a very early age, I'm broken. I don't feel right. Kids talk, and I'm like, that's not what I'm experiencing here. I don't. I like this story. I remember being in third grade. I'm standing next to my best friend, Lance, and we're deciding whether we're going to go play dodgeball or kickball. And I turned to Lance, and I said, hey, Lance, what do your voices tell you? And his eyes got this big, and he ran away, and I spent the next several hours in the nurse's office with the nurse, the principal, and my parents on the phone about the voices Chris hears in his head. And I learned from a very early age, don't talk about this stuff, right? And one of my very first meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy, and he shared about the committee in his head. And I thought, I knew it wasn't just me. I knew other people had that, and I could talk about that here. The 16 people who tell me to do stuff. And it's interesting because I've always known that there was something wrong with me. And I grew up in a way where things stuck with me and they bothered me. And I could tell you about painful times and all the good memories. I don't really remember all that many of them. Maybe there wasn't. It's because there weren't that many. I don't know. But I could tell you about one of my very first memories. I was a small kid. My brother, who is just older than me, was pinning me down while my oldest brother was down the hall. And he was pulling the eyes out of my favorite stuffed animal. And I was screaming for him to stop. I remember crying. And I was trying to get free so I'd go save my stuffed animal, right? And I couldn't. And I still it was so hard that day. And my brother's laughing. And I thought, what? I could tell you about being 13 years old and I got a loaded 1911 45 in my hand. I'm going to walk into my dad's room while he's taking a nap. And I'm going to blow his head off because I hate him. I can tell you all about that. I can tell you about my first girlfriend who I really thought I was going to marry. I can tell you about how she slept with my best friend. And it was like taking a dull butter knife and hacking into my chest and ripping my heart out and throwing it on the ground and stepping on it and spitting on it, right? I could tell you about that. And she left me there bleeding to die. Not that I'm resentful, right? I can tell you all about that stuff. But I can tell you about a day when I was 15 years old. I went to Highway 39, which is a drive-in movie theater, and three of my friends and I pimped some Mickey Big Mouth malt liquor, and I pulled the top off of one of those, and I drank it, and I met God. Right? I drank three or four of those in about 45 minutes, and I no longer had that. I went like this. I took my first real breath, and you can't explain that to a guy who's not alcoholic. He doesn't understand that. It's one of my therapists could never understand me. He doesn't understand what I've gone through. And it's amazing. When I drank, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. When I drank, I didn't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I could drink alcohol and be in a room with a chick who ruined my life, and I'd be cool. Right? It gave me such relief. It's interesting. You go through all those nights that promises, and I realized that alcohol was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And when it says, are these extravagant promises? We think not. It's not that they're not extravagant promises because I've done all this work in AA to make halfway through my amends. They're not extravagant promises because I experienced every single one of them when I drank alcohol. Alcohol gave me such huge relief, and I thank God for every drop I ever drank, because if I didn't start drinking at the age of 15, I would have blown my head off. It gave me the relief I needed, and it expedited a bottom that I couldn't manufacture until I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I could find a solution that would help. I had to have alcohol to get me here. And it's amazing. I'm not going to bore you through my stories of my drinking. We all know how to drink, otherwise we wouldn't be in here. I'm not going to tell you, just don't drink no matter what. Choose not to drink. Do the next right thing. Because if you can do those things, you might be in the wrong room. Because this room is for people who have shown time after time, don't do the right thing, even though I know what it is, who can choose not to drink, who has every need and necessity in which to not pick up a drink, and I do. I can't not just not drink no matter what. That's why I'm here. Because if I could choose not to drink, my happy ass right now would be at home. Right? Not here. After a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I wound up in treatment. I'd been living 9 months on the streets, and I got this opportunity from the man who I had hated. He gave me an opportunity to get sober, and he put me into treatment that he worked at the same hospital. Ironically, it's the same hospital I was born at in Long Beach. And I had no idea the difference between Alcoholics Anonymous, treatment centers. I knew it wasn't jail, right? That's a good start. So I went. And in that hospital, in that treatment center, they had a morning meeting that was there every 6:30. We would go. And I thought all of it was the same. I thought my counselor worked for AA. And I didn't know the difference. And they told me to do all these things. And I'm good at doing stuff. You tell me to do stuff, I'll do it. They said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to over 300. Because when you don't have a job, you can go to 3-4 meetings a day. Right? You tell me what to do and I'll do my very best to do it. And they said, get a sponsor and call them every day. Got a sponsor, I called them every day. Until I got in a year sober and he said, Chris, quit calling me every day. You're bothering me. But I didn't know. I didn't know because the treatment center said, call me. So I did. I had an experience with what he called the 12 steps to later find out that wasn't the steps, and it went like this. Chris, are you pals over alcohol? Yes. I don't know what that means, but yes. I guess that describes what's going on here. Do you believe in God? Yes, I do. He didn't ask me what kind of God, because I believe in a very punishing God. I grew up Catholic, and that should explain a lot about me, right? He said, do you want to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to God? And I said, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that, right? And then next thing you know, I'm writing an inventory. And that's my first, and I had no idea. This guy, sober 8 years, said, you are now in step four, and I thought I was in the four step. Why? Because that guy told me that. And so I start writing this inventory, and it wasn't out of this book. It was some really neat mimeograph sheets, and it was just such a weird experience. I answered all these questions, and I did the sex inventory, and I read it to him. I did a fifth step. It took me 15 minutes before the Thursday night fights meeting in Seal Beach, and every Thursday night there was a fight in this place. It's awesome. And I finished, and he said, okay, we're done with the steps. And I was done with the steps. He said, I'm done. My sponsor, now I'm ready to sponsor people. Oh, my God. Talk about problems. I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but my sponsor says I'm ready. I had no idea. I had no idea. But I had gotten some relief. I had gotten some relief from those problems. You know what? The AA gave me a way to, when I thought of my dad, I could share about it 10 million times in one of the 15 million meetings I'm going to a week, right? Or if I could see her, I could write about it and write a gratitude list and blah, blah, right? I get relief from it. But after a year of that, it wasn't working anymore and the relief had stopped. I wasn't getting alleviation from the internal pain that was killing me. And I was like, I'm dying. I'm a year sober and I'm not stupid. I might not look bright, but I pay attention. And you guys look happy, and you're getting something more than relief, and I'm not getting it. And if I'm not getting it in this room, I can get it from booze. I guarantee you. I go drink, you people change. You people become more tolerable, right? Some meetings I wish I could drink at. I'm kidding. And I went to this man who took me through the 12 steps his way, said, dude, I'm dying. I'm gone. I'm out. Thank you very much for your time, but I'm going to kill myself. And rather than kill myself, I'm going to go drink. You know, that's there you go. And he said, Chris, what I've done with you is work with a lot of people. It worked with me. It's what I was showing what to do. But it's not helping you, man. Here's the address of a meeting. I want you to go to it. These people have what you want. I'm desperate. I'm desperate to do whatever it takes. And this meeting was in South Central Los Angeles. Asians really don't hang out in South Central unless you own a liquor store, right? So I take my happy Asian ass to South Central, and I walk into this meeting. I'm used to Orange County, right? Everybody all nicely dressed, and he's sharing, right? And these people are jumping up, screaming, hallelujah, bearing witness and praising. Praising the power and grace of God and bearing witness to AA. And I'm like, I'm in the wrong place, man. I gotta get out. And I'm trying to get out the door. And I hear this guy get from my podium. He says, my name's Hayward and I'm an alcoholic. And I stopped. And I can't tell you why. I can't tell you what he said. But I knew I had to talk to that guy. And after the meeting, I walked right up to him. I said, dude, I gotta talk to you. And he said, I know you're the reason why I'm here tonight. And I thought, you arrogant prick. Right? What the hell? We talked a bit, and we're nothing alike. I come from a middle upper class neighborhood, right? And this guy's a gangbanger, crip from Compton. But when we'd shared, it was like, I know this guy. We're connected. He said, call me tomorrow. So I called him. We talked. Next day he said, call me tomorrow. I called him. Next day he says, call me tomorrow. I call him. He says, okay, I want you to call this guy. And his name was Joe. He lived in Santa Monica. He just moved there from Denver. I called Joe, and I said, yeah, Hayward told me to call you. He said, good, come over. I don't know you, dude. Okay. And I go over there. He started asking me some questions about my drinking. He started asking me about my experience in AA. He started asking me weird questions like, so what do you do to be of service, and what do you do to carry the message? And I said, well, Wednesday nights I go to the treatment center and I grab all the guys and I take them to a men's meeting. And he said, That's not carrying the message. That's carrying the alcoholic to the message. You don't have a message to carry. What you have is a car. And I'm thinking, what is it with you guys, man? But what they're doing is they're trying to smash my ego. And I needed that. And what Joe did with me that day was the exact same thing I did with Kathy and all the guys I take through the steps. The first thing we do is we sit down and I make damn sure you're an alcoholic before we get into the steps. Because if you're not alcoholic, you don't need to be in this room. And I think AA is contaminated with people who aren't really alcoholic. Or the book talks about a certain type of hard drinker. They get in trouble. They wind up in treatment centers. But they don't suffer from what I discovered was the allergy to alcohol. Right? They, a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, these people can stop or moderate. They may find it difficult and troublesome. Right? But nobody ever cares enough about them to tell them that you're not really alcoholic, you're a hard drinker. What you need to go do is, you know what, you need to work a little better with your boss. You need to go to counseling with your wife. You need to get laid more, eat better, right? And your life will be better. You don't need to be chained to AA. You don't. We're supposed to be getting each other free. And sometimes we get a guy because he sounds alcoholic, because he's got bad stories, and he's not. And then what happens when you got a guy who can just not drink no matter what because he's a hard drinker, and you get a guy like me who does drink no matter what, and I ask that guy to be my sponsor? I'm going to die, and it almost happened. Almost happened to me. And it was interesting because Joe started talking about stuff that I'm like, well, that's like a pearl of wisdom, man. You need to write that down. And then he would show me what page it came out of the book. He would go, well, it's right here and there's a solution. I'd be like, holy shit. And I had such an amazing experience with that man. Because this guy, he did what was taught for him. His sponsor took him through this book word by word, page by page. There was a dictionary in the room. We went through the words and we looked them up. And he shared his experience of how he got his spiritual experience through working these 12 steps right out of this book by doing that with me so I could get my own experience. I like what it says on top page 29. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how he recovered. So if I'm not doing the 12 steps out of this book, I'm not doing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some people get mad at me about that. I don't care. Go kick rocks. Go do whatever you're going to do. I tell you what. Why don't you, my last name's Chun, C-H-U-N. Put that on your next inventory if you ever write one and see what you get. I something just comes over me sometimes. Because I deal with that on a daily basis. Some people get mad about the words come out of my mouth, but I don't say them. You know what? I would love to be the popular guy in AA and everybody love me. But you know what? I don't want to be popular. Being popular in AA is like being the most popular guy in the insane asylum. Right? I do not want to be infamous in this anonymous program. I want to be effective. I want to get the guy. I don't look for people I can help in AA. Because what you end up with is people you can help. And if I can help you, you're not alcoholic. Because no human power can relieve what we suffer from. I look for the guys who nobody can help, who have no hope. And I hand deliver them to God. And I let God fix them. It's not my job. It's interesting because my first step when my first sponsor asked me, are you powerless over alcohol? I didn't know what that meant. And when Joe was done with me going through the first 43 pages, we talked about the allergy. Which I wished somebody would have told me a long time ago. Instead of Chris, I'm like 13 or 14, this Harvard-educated shrink saying, Chris, I believe you're a sociopath because you exhibit behavior that has no regard for social rules or guidelines. I'm like, well, yeah, that's me, right? I guess I'm a sociopath. And no, I'm just alcoholic, right? People, you say, Chris, why do you drink this way? And people pressure me, and I came out, I blurted out one day, I don't care. And you know what? That sounded right. I don't show up for my own birthday party. I don't show up for Thanksgiving. I don't show up for Christmas. I don't show up for my dad's award ceremony. And I would say because I don't care. But what started happening is because I really did care. And when you talk about what Dr. Silkworth talks about, that we have that we suffer from this phenomenon of craving. When we start to drink, something physically happens and I have to drink more. It explained those times when I was in a bar and I have three beers and I get this burn. And the only thing that'll put that burnout is a lot of Jack Daniels, right? And the waitress isn't coming quick enough. And I'm like, look, bitch, bring me five. No Coke. No, just bring me the bottle, man. What? Lady, what's your problem? And that's when I stopped going to bars. It's like, forget it. I'll sit home and then I can put the fire out. It's like, oh, thank God. Thank God. People don't understand that unless you're alcoholic. I have this physical craving for alcohol that only more alcohol is going to like eat. And it's hard though, because sometimes three drinks will relieve that itch. But what started happening more and more often is it's like having sex with a 600-pound gorilla. I'm not done when I say I'm done. We're done when it says I'm done. Right? And it has its way with me. That's what it was like towards the end. I'm not drinking because it's a lovely, wonderful thing to do, because it's not. I'm drinking because I have to, and no matter what I've got going on, I can't stop it. And people used to shake their heads. You ever get that look? Oh, here he is again. I'm so used to that, and I thought it's because I was a sociopath. It's because I have an allergy. And that made sense. Like it says, it explains many things for which we could not otherwise account. And I'm like, wow, thank God. And I understood the physical part being powerless, and they talked about the mental part. And it's interesting. I'm 14 years sober at Disney World, the happiest place on earth. Who would have thought the happiest place on earth was in Florida? But it is, apparently. I'm sitting there, I'm working for this company, and they're going to give me an award. The CEO is going to give me this award in front of 4,000 people. Happiest day. It's interesting. So I'm not hungry this day because I'm eating a steak and lobster dinner. So I don't got to worry about drinking. I'm not hungry. I'm not angry because I'm about to receive an achievement award. Anger's nowhere on the radar for me. I'm not lonely. I'm with my wife and some of my best friends from work. So I'm not lonely. I'm not tired. I rode rides all day and I just got it from a nap. I'm not hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. I'm not going to drink on this day. But Florida's hot and humid. You know what goes good on a hot, humid day in Florida? Two ice-cold Heinekens, right? This hotel is great. They figure out what's going to freeze the beer, and then they take it back one click, right? It's so cold. Great on a hot day. You know what tastes real good with steak and lobster? Two ice-cold Heinekens. Truth, truth. You know what helps me in getting up in front of 4,000 people takes the edge off of that? Two Heinekens. Huh. The interesting thing about that is some people make it sound like my relapse is going to wave a halt sign. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired, danger, beware. No, dude. That's the biggest lie of all. My relapse, like it talks about, this insane thought parallels my sound reasoning. The reason why I drink is because it looks like a sane, logical idea. And I don't drink on a lie. I drink because the truth is, two beers on a hot day in front of 4,000 people with a steak and lobster dinner is good. The lie is that I'm not allergic to it. And when I drink those two, it's going to kick off an allergic reaction. And at 14 years sober, that's exactly what I did. Because I'm insane when it comes to alcohol. I'm not talking about doing the same thing over again, expecting a different result. I'm going to poke my eye out when I hear that. It's Albert Einstein wrote that down. You know what Albert Einstein did? He was working on the theory of relativity, doing these exact precise experiments. It would make no sense for Albert Einstein to do an exact measurement, calibrated experiment, and then do the exact same thing over again, expecting a different result, right? We're not talking about that. We're talking about me being alcoholic. I like the definition that they use in this book. It says on page 37 that it's a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. I don't think straight when it comes to alcohol. That's insanity for me as an alcoholic. I've never thought, oh, I'm going to drink tonight and I'm going to expect a different result. I've never thought that. Ever. Ever. I have gotten out of jail after a fight that I had been in. My dad had to come pick me up. I'm sober by this time, going to get my car to impound, and I was drunk in a blackout, got in a fight. The guy had major surgery, and I'm in a lot of trouble with the law. And you know what the first thing I did, where I drove my car to? I went and bought a bottle of Blue Label Smirnoff and a 12-pack Coors Light, and I drank it all. No, but I'm going to do the same thing over again. I'm going to expect a different result. No. I have a lack of proportionate ability to think straight. I cannot connect the blackout fight jail to me going to liquor store and buying more booze. I'm insane when it comes to alcohol, and I have no power over that. I cannot choose not to drink. I'm alcoholic. And I started to realize, after going through this, why I'm powerless. And for the first time in my life, I understood what this was about. If I'm powerless, I must get power, right? They talked about this unmanageability in my life. And I used to think that my life was unmanageable because of the jails and the problems and the fights, the results of my drinking, but that's not the case. I've written enough inventory on my life to know that my life is unmanageable way before I ever took my first drink. It talks about, bottom page 44, top page 45, that if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But I can't do these things. I can't will them with all my might. I've known what the next right thing to do is, and I don't do it. The biggest example I've got is, I was going to buy some beer with a bunch of friends of mine. There was this homeless lady, and my friends were picking on her, and I think this is a bad thing that they're doing. I'm going to go stop them. And what I find myself doing is going over there, knocking the ground and kicking her in the head as hard as I can, because my friends are laughing. And I'm not raised to do this shit. And I'm beating this woman, spitting on her, and I can't stop myself because my life is unmanageable. I know what the right thing to do is, and I can't stop myself. I'm an animal. And you know what I do to forget that? I drink. And I drink, trying to bury this crap until I couldn't bury it anymore. And I hit the doors of AA. And I see the unmanageability of my life, my being powerless, and I better come to believe in a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity, or I'm dead. And you know what? Somebody should shoot me. Put me in a penitentiary, because that's where I belong. Guys like me? Shit. Put me there. I'll voluntarily go because I know what I'm going to do if you don't. And it's interesting because my first response said, do you believe in God? And I said, yes. It's hard because I used to think that we agnostics, and I like that it says we agnostics, not once agnostic, or we used to be agnostics until we did what was in this chapter. It's we agnostics still today. I'm agnostic. We are agnostics. And that's why I continue to write inventory to see this stuff. But on page 52, it says, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas didn't work. The God idea did. My first response was asking about my past relationship with God, when what this book was trying to do was erase what I think I know about God and look at your relationship with God. And I'm in these meetings with some arch criminals, people who've done horrendous things who don't do them anymore. And I would walk up to them. I said, dude, what? How? How do you not? And they were all of them. And it's a hard time. I mean, pedophiles, rapists, murderers, right? The worst society has to offer. And they're telling me, I watch these guys give their lives to people they don't even know. And I say, why? And they say, because of this power I found through working these 12 steps that allows me to live this life sober. I'm like, wow. They presented a powerful reason why I should have faith in this. And how my God idea didn't work and their God idea does. I came to believe in a power greater than me by looking at their relationship, not looking at my past one. And that gave me the power to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to God. Because something's got to happen with me. And it's not just my drinking. I'm talking about will and life. And it's only a decision, though. Just because I make a decision doesn't mean shit's going to happen. It's like, three alcoholics sitting in a bar, two decide to go to AA. How many are sitting at the bar?
Three.
All three. Because they only made a decision. I can make a decision until I'm blue in the face. Until I take some action, nothing's going to happen. My sponsor, I wrote my prayer, like this book told me to do. And I knelt down with a grown man. I held his hands. And I read a prayer that I wrote about turning my will and my life over to God. You know what that did? The amazing part of that is it went from these really old dudes who I don't know writing a book 70 years ago into this being my experience with these 12 steps. I wrote a prayer asking God to turn my will and my life over to Him. And I jumped up and I thought I was going to go home and mull this whole thing over, and he gave me a spiral notebook and a pen, and he gave me the directions on how to start writing inventory. I sit down, and I say, because the most important part of that third step decision is I'm going to ask God for direction. He said, I want you to use these list of prayers, and I want you to write inventory. I sat down and said, God, please bring to mind everyone I've ever been angry with. I mean, the names are, I'm not an angry, vomiting names all over this paper, everywhere. I'm seeing names come off the tip of my pen. Mrs. Robinson, wow, that's my first grade teacher. Patty, third grade, she pulled down my pants. I'm like, holy crap. I asked God to show me, and he showed me in great measure. And you know, I could bore you with the details of that inventory. I ended up having 488 names on it. I was like, that's a good inventory. God showed me, and I called my buddy, and he said, I got 1,800. I'm like, wow, dude. I don't care. I people show me their inventory and show me their four step, and they're all proud of it. I don't like being like this, but I'd rather be effective than be popular. And their inventory doesn't look like it's a four column inventory like described in this book. It's got all these bells and whistles and drawing diagrams, and I'm this kind of alcoholic, and I do this when... No, man. And they say, what do you think? And I say, well, that's not a four step. And I hurt their feelings. I'm sorry. I care more about whether you live or die than how you feel. I like what it says on page 137. We alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow this serious handicap. If your inventory does not look like the example, you're not doing AA's inventory. It says precise directions. And so I do exactly what's in this book. I wrote that inventory. I did the sex inventory. I did all of it, just like the book talks about. I called Joe up and said, my inventory's done. And I thought he was going to say, it was a Wednesday morning. I called him intentionally on Wednesday so I could take a couple days and take a break. He said, I'm clearing my schedule. Come over right now. I'm like, wait, seriously? Don't, what? Huh? I drive my happy ass to Santa Monica and I read inventory. It took him 8 hours. Well, it actually took 10 hours. We took a couple of breaks in there to eat and do stuff. Because this book talks about being prepared for a long talk. It talks about going back through your life. It talks about writing down a lot. We're not interested in my top 10 resentments. We're not. And it's amazing. I write down all of this stuff and I read it to a guy. And it's interesting because the book talks about reading it to person or persons. I've always read my inventory to more than one guy. I read my inventory until those fifth step promises on 75 come true, that I can look the world in the eye. I'm no longer afraid that the feeling of a drink has fallen from me and it comes strongly. I will read my inventory to people until that happens. I don't believe the promises are promises. I believe they're mile markers so I can see where I'm at. Am I? It's actually, I think, those are for the sponsor to make sure you're in the right space before you move on. If you're not experiencing the promises in the third step, I need to go back with you and review some stuff to see what I've missed. That's my job. And it talks about reading inventory to your wife or best friend, but you can't disclose anything that might hurt them. I read inventory to my wife every single time I write inventory. Poor Kathy has probably heard more of my inventories than I've heard of hers. I read inventory. I'm not afraid of it. It's amazing the freedom that I get. From I'll write and read inventory the drop of a hat. Why? Because it means when I write inventory, I get to go out and make amends. Because when I make amends, I get free and I find other opportunities God wants me to be of service. And that's a huge miracle. I read my inventory. I do 6 and 7. And I get the great realization that from looking at my inventory, it talks about in the 7-step prayer to give this stuff good and bad to God. And the reason why it's good and bad is because I don't know the difference. And I notice the on the beam, off the beam stuff. I don't like that. It's very misleading to think that when I'm being honest and generous and sympathetic, that I'm a great guy. Until you find out that I'm being honest and sympathetic and kind because I want to screw you over. I'm going to get something from you, right? And then I have all my bad stuff of resentment, anger, and selfishness. And then when I look at that and I see what a great relationship I have with you and from God now, because I've made amends for that, and it turns out my bad stuff was good, my good stuff was bad. What 6 and 7 were for me about was, relieving me of the judgment of and just giving it to God. And today I move through my life and I don't look for good or bad or what to do. I ask God to show me where your thread is. And every moment I just look for the thread of God. There it is. And I get to move into this moment. Where's God? And I get to, and that's how I live my life. And it's amazing. I get into 8 and 9 and I end up for my first inventory. I got to make 355 amends from that first inventory. It took me 3 years to do it. And I do exactly what's in this book. It talks about, it gives the directions kind of split up, but I'm supposed to tell you exactly why I'm there. And it's not about I'm sorry. I'm supposed to clean up the wreckage. My old home group, it was a meeting where it was 9, 10, 11, or 12, and you couldn't get up from behind a podium and share unless you were in those steps. Because if you weren't in those steps, we don't give a shit about what you have to say, because it's an opinion, right? And I would, week after week, hear these people get up and tell you about a miracle that happened in their life through amends. How they thought this thing, and it, so the real purpose of amends is it is about cleaning up my wreckage, but it says on top page 77 that my real purpose is to put myself to be in a position where I can be of maximum service to God and people about me. I don't know what that's going to look like. So I hear my friends making amends that are going to put him back in jail. I got a friend who went back to the warden of the institution he was at, prison, and he said, I am here to make amends to you because I sold drugs when I was here. And this guy's still on paper. And the warden could lock him up back in jail. But he said, Chris, I am willing to make this amends because I would rather be a truthful guy in Alcoholics Anonymous than a phony, and behind the walls, than a phony sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that put a lot of weight on me because I got amends that I don't want to make because I'm scared. So I go back to this employer that I steal from. I admit to stealing $25,000 from them. When they fired me, they wanted to put me in prison, but they could not prove it. And I know I'm going back to jail this day. I went and talked to, I did exactly what this book talks about, consult an attorney. I talked to my attorney, he said, Chris, this is really stupid. Right? But he's had these discussions before with me. This is one of my last amends. But he says, you know what? If something happens, call me. You know, I'll look for your number. And so I go and I meet with the president of the company, the owner of the company, and my direct supervisor, and I do exactly what this book says. My name's Chris and I'm an alcoholic. In order for me to stay sober, I clean up the wreckage of my past and inventory my life. I've seen where I stole $25,000 from you. And here's my fault, my mistake, my blame, not my part, my fault. And I read where I was selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid right out of my fourth column. And I asked them the three magic questions. Is there anything else that I've done that's harmed you? And I let them answer. How did this affect you? Because I'm so egotistical that I think I know how my shit affects you. I've gone to people and I think I've crushed them with my behavior. And my ego is like, I'm so sorry for what I did to you. Let me read this. Right? And they go, I don't even remember that. Actually, I really don't remember you. And I, right? Then there are times where I think that, you know what? I didn't hurt them. This is going to be one of those little resentments. This is stupid. And I go back and I read my card and I'm ready for a hug. And they say, sit down. I'm not done with you by a long shot. And I find out how I affected them. That's the miracle of amends. And so these guys tell me, and I ask them the last and most important question, is what can I do to make this right? I'm willing to do whatever. And they all shared with me, Chris, you know what? We really cared about you. We didn't know what was wrong with you, but we couldn't keep you here anymore. We couldn't afford it. Right? And I think that's what the amends is all about. And I go back to my home group, praising the power of God, bearing witness to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't go back to jail. If you're afraid of making amends, go do it. And I've met people who did go back to jail. I have. And they carried the message behind the walls. And I think that's where my amends ends. A year later, I'm at work. I'm bopping along, real low-key and quiet, like I am. And I turn around, and my old boss is standing right here, short guy. And you could tell when a guy's been crying. And his face is just red, and he's beating bags under his eye. I'm like, Mike, what's wrong? And he gives me this hug, and we're standing there. And he said, Chris, I remember when you came and saw us a year ago and what you talked about that day. And my daughter is hooked on meth. Can you please help me? Holy shit. I could not see that coming. How does that happen? God turned my fear of going back and making amends that could have landed me back in the Gray Bar Hotel into about me being there for him a year later. Maximum service to God and the people about him. I tell you story after story after story after story. And then I go into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hear a woman share, well, I owe this place money, so I go to 7-Eleven, I buy bags of ice, and I don't take them out of the cooler until I'm square. And people are like, oh. And then I'm the a-hole in the room who jumps up and says, what? Are you serious? The steps say direct amends. It says I must not shrink at anything. What are we talking about? I'm supposed to risk jail. I'm supposed to risk losing face. And what does the new guy hear? Well, the new guy hears this guy over here facing jail, doing these scary things. And then this lady over here is talking about buying bags of ice and not taking them out of the cooler. Who do I want to work with? What? Now I'm the bad guy. I'll do that all day long. I don't care. I don't care anymore about what these people who turn the program of Alcoholics Anonymous into this easy relief program. I'm not here to give you relief. I'm here to show you how to get free from alcohol and help thousands of people you will never, ever meet. It's interesting. One of the first things Joe showed me. This is my third edition. And on this paper cover, it says, but the basic text, pages 1 through 164, remains unchanged. This is the AA message. This. I used to think that the AA message came from a guy who had multiple years sharing his horse shit. And it's not. And then I got to share in this room of hard drinkers about what it's like to be a real alcoholic. And then people get mad at me. I've had people. I helped a guy find out that he wasn't an alcoholic. He was a hard drinker. His name was Billy. He didn't need to be an AA. And he asked me to take him through the steps. And I showed him. I didn't tell him, Billy, you're not really alcoholic. But I knew he wasn't from when I qualified him. And I met him week after week. 2 months later, we're talking about the allergy. And he said, Chris, I got to tell you, I'm not alcoholic. I'm a hard drinker. I don't have this allergy you're talking about. And I said, I know. I've been waiting 2 months for you to say that. You don't need AA. You can get free. And if our group had their way with him, he would be sober right now sponsoring people. And I had three members of our group corner me in a parking lot and tell me, who are you to say he's not alcoholic? I said, well, page 92 says, if you're satisfied, he's a real alcoholic, so... Some people think that I'm this timid little Asian guy, right? I'm not. You corner me like that, I'm sorry, I may throttle you. Because I'm not well. I got character defects, man. But I promise you this, I will make amends for it after, right? I'm passionate about this because I'm watching us kill each other. And it's hurtful. And I do what my sponsor tells me. My sponsor won't go to open discussion meetings. He won't. Because he just can't do it. He doesn't have the energy for it. And he said the last time I met with him last month, he said, I'm glad you're doing it. Because one of us has to. Man, I get this freedom from making amends. Freedom. You know what? It's interesting. What before I was getting in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would see my dad and I would have all this pain and I would share it in a meeting or write about it and then I would get alleviation from that pain and experience relief. I did what this book said and I went and I made my amends to that man. A man that I hated. Not bad stuff, right? Nothing horrific. Just some things. He wasn't the dad I thought he should be. He didn't hug me and tell me he loved me. You know, he was never there for me, right? When I made amends to that man, what I saw in my fourth column was, one of my biggest ones, I looked at this inventory and I realized that all the things that I was doing was causing him to not want to be around me, to not love me, and to not be the dad that I wanted him to be. It wasn't his fault, it was mine from what I was doing. I saw the lie in the first two columns in the fourth. And I made amends for that. I wish I could tell you after I made my amends, he hugged me and said, Chris, I love you. You're the son that I've always wanted. And we skipped down a gold path with doves and rainbows flying out of our butt. And it didn't happen. Did not happen. He was still the same prick that I'd always known. But what changed that day was me. I got free through that amends. And I went over there all the time, and I was a son to that man. And 5 years later, I was leaving my mom and dad's house after helping them do some work. And my dad called my name as I was leaving out the door. He said, "Hey, Chris." And I stopped and I turned around. He walked up to me and he hugged me and he said, "Chris, I love you." And I cried. I cried. I didn't get sober for that. I didn't. I got sober to stop drinking. Thank God that's not why I'm here today. The interesting thing was my dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer. I quit my job, making a lot of money, so I could be with him. I think God gave me that job and surprised me so I could make a lot of money, so I quit that job and I could be there for a man who I had hated, who I now loved. The day of his death, I got to spend 2 hours. We'd all been at this hospital. He'd been battling it and finally said, "You know what? I don't want any more medication. I don't want you washing my blood anymore. I just want to die." It's hard because when he first got cancer, they said he's got 6 months to live. He lived 5 years. The day he said, "I don't want any more treatment," they said, "You're going to live a couple of weeks," and he died 6 hours later. Doctors don't know crap. I mean, it's just so hard. We've been in this hospital. Nobody showered, nobody did anything. And when he made his decision, everybody left, and I refused to go home. And I got to spend 2 hours with that man. And you know what? We talked, and he shared about his life and the things that he was proud of. He gave the instructions about taking care of my mom to me and not to my older brothers. My doctor brother, my vice president brother, he gave it to me. And it wasn't until later, when I was talking with my sponsor, he said, "Chris, you don't realize the miracle, do you? That the day you made that amends, you got to spend 2 hours with your dad on his deathbed, and he got to talk about whatever he wanted to, and it wasn't consumed with 2 hours of you're trying to reconcile a relationship that's been screwed up the whole time. You got to let him die talking about what he wanted to talk to." What kind of miracle is that? I didn't get sober for that. I didn't. I do a moving inventory. I'm part of a meditation group, a year-long deal, man. Every day we say these phrases. And if you would hear our weekly meeting Thursday nights, I used to walk through libraries or airports. I hear talking about Jesus and God and stuff. I'd think, look at those lunatics. If I would record one of these Thursday nights, you would have all of us committed about what we're talking about God and the miracles thereof, because we all have a conscious relationship with God today. I could tell you about yesterday, how I saw. I could tell you about today, this moment, how I've been able to see, feel, touch, and use God because I have a conscious relationship. I don't sit and go, "Well, I'm going to pray and meditate and try and find God. Well, couldn't find him today. Oh, well." God, I tell you, God moves with me everywhere I go, every place. And I carry that into when I'm working with people. My life today is a complete miracle. I cannot express to you. We had a son. My wife and I had a son 19 months ago. 5 years ago when my wife and I got sober, we were literally signing divorce papers. We were done because we were drinking. I wasn't even living there anymore. And we didn't sign them that day. I was sitting in the backyard drinking beer, and I couldn't drink any more beer. And that's so hard when you want to get drunk and you can't drink. And you're sitting, I'm on a patio, and I hear, "Chris, go to a meeting." And I thought somebody was screwing with me. I heard it. I know the difference between the 16 guys who talk and somebody saying something. I look over the fence. I heard it. The next morning, I'm in my closet and I hear it again. "Chris, go to a meeting." "No, I'm not." I call Renee up. "Renee, I got to go to a meeting. You want to go?" She was sober too. She relapsed. And being the good codependent she is, she found one. And we went. It's interesting because I often think of powerless as drinking when I don't want to. Being truly powerless is wanting to drink and God not letting you. I don't have any power over drinking. God won't let me drink. That's what this stuff is about. I turn my will and my life over to God, and at some point it's about, am I willing to live life on terms other than my own? We're looking at foreclosure, repossession of a truck. We're going to try and stay together. And slowly, I talked to a guy that I looked in Texas for somebody to take me through the steps. I couldn't find anybody. If I'm going to put my life in your hands, you better know what the hell's going on. And if I ask you about cement on page 17, you better know the answer. If I ask you about the cornerstone and the keystone, you better know the answer. If you haven't made your amends, I'm not going to ask you to be my sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, no. 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 Yeah, seriously? Oh, yeah. Here's my life. Mr. I don't have a sponsor because I'm so well. I did what this book said. I could have gotten a job making money that would have fixed all of our money problems, and I didn't. I did what it said on page 19. And it said, it talks about, I got to work with other alcoholics. So all I had strenuous work, one alcoholic with another. And that's what I did. My very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of others and how I can help meet their needs. By the time I had written inventory, read it, by the time I was 3 months sober, and finished with all my amends by the time I was 6 months sober. I was 3 months sober, and the first person at the Frisco group asked me to sponsor them, and it was a woman with 5 years. You want to see a group of sober alcoholics lose their God? Have a guy with 3 months take a woman with 5 years. I had another group of guys talk to me in the parking lot. I'm like, what? Responsibility pledge says when anyone anywhere reaches out their hand for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. She asked me. Yeah, I understand. Some guys who've never written a sex inventory, who have problems with sex, you shouldn't sponsor a woman. But this lady needed help, and I knew nobody else could help her in that way. God's given me the power to help others. And so I do that. I sat down and got through the steps. By the time I was 6 months sober, I sponsored 25 people. And I've been right around that number. That's what I do. I don't worry about my life. I retired a year ago. We've got tens of thousands of dollars in the bank. We have no car payments. We just bought a dream home. I can tell you about the miracle about that. We shouldn't have got that home. It was a mistake. And what I'm saying, it was a mistake. We should not have got that home. And I walk in it every day and I laugh. And I'm like, looking at Rita going, man, when the owners get back here, they're going to be pissed. Right? I retired. My dad, one of the things he said when I was deathbed, he said, Chris, I hope you don't make the mistake I made. And when you have a child, you spend time with him. When my son was about 6 months old, my wife and I talked about it. And I'm like, I'm going to quit working. Let's readjust things. We've got money now. I want to be a stay-at-home dad. I stay at home with that boy every day. I take naps with him and play with him. We go outside. Every day. I go with him to the store. I change his dirty diapers. We laugh. We fall down. We play. And it's unbelievable. I mean, starting school Tuesday, and I don't know how I'm going to do that. I'm not going to have an excuse to take a nap. Right? Reedy's going to be going, what the hell are you doing? Nap time? He's not here. Right? Another miracle. Last week, I went on two interviews. I met with the director of a financial institution. And Friday, I had a phone interview with New York with the executive recruiters. I'm going back to work, it looks like. A bank is giving me a vice president of compliance and surveillance position. What? Are you kidding me? I'm a felon. What? I'm in charge? Here's the really screwed up part of it. The guy who's going to be my boss, I took through the steps 3 years ago. He's the executive director of that department. The first day I met him, he came to a book study I was doing, and he sat with his arms crossed and just stared at me. He's mad. I thought this guy was going to punch me after the meeting. I'm used to that, right? And after the meeting, he walked up to me and said, Chris, I got to talk to you. And I said, I know, you're the reason why I'm here. He got a brand new experience. That man is free today. And he asked me if I would come to work for him because I have good work ethic. And I'm probably getting the job offer Wednesday from what he's telling me. I didn't work for that. Wasn't even on my radar. It's all falling together. And the only thing I got to do is find another alcoholic who cannot stay sober. And I take him through this book. I used to say I take their hand and put it in God's hands through the 12 steps. And today I realize all I do is I help them wipe the crap off their face so they can see the God that's always been right there. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love this group. And I'm looking for, Brian and I are talking about coming back to that 4-step workshop and come back in January to finish up the steps. man, I love God, I love AA, and I love all you guys, and I look forward to coming back. Thanks for letting me share.